The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. This hour, uncomfortable conversations during this long, hot summer. As crime spikes in cities across the country, one retired cop talks about where the conversation about policing and violence need to go. Also, a call to Catholics from Pope Francis, taking on issues that have long been considered uncomfortable for the church, including abortion. And we're talking tech and love. Does your smartphone make you avoid real conversation altogether?
Hi, this is Hillary Smith from Cotati, California. My husband and I do have similar tech habits, plenty of online shopping, but no Facebook or social media. We just moved to and have agreed to keep all screens out of the bedroom.
All screens out of the bedroom. What about screens out of your relationship entirely? Have your say. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. A lot more on that conversation later this hour. But we begin in Washington, where President Obama appears now to have secured enough votes to guarantee the Iran nuclear deal. On Tuesday, two more Democratic senators, Bob Casey of Pennsylvania and Chris Coons of Delaware, pledged their support for the deal. And then earlier today, retiring Democratic Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski said she's on board. And that makes 34 senators in support, enough to guarantee that Congress can't override a veto if lawmakers were to block the deal. Here's Senator Coons in a speech at the University of Delaware on Tuesday.
We cannot trust Iran, but this deal, based on distrust, verification, deterrence, and strong principled multilateral diplomacy, offers us what is today our best remaining opportunity to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon.
So three more Democratic holdouts are on board, and with the vote approaching in mid-September, it now looks like it could pass without a single Republican in the Senate or the House voting for it. Amber Phillips, political reporter for The Washington Post, says it's been a slow, steady push to reach that magic number of 34.
When the deal was announced in July, by my count, we had one Democratic senator supporting the deal, pledging to support the deal. The rest were kind of undecided. But yet, week by week, we've seen two senators supporting the deal, three senators supporting the deal. And as you mentioned, the magic number here for the president to keep his deal is 34. And I think what's been going on is the president has engaged in an intense lobbying effort. You know, you heard Senator Coons yesterday announce his support. He mentioned that morning he got a handwritten detailed note from the president trying to assuage his concerns about the deal. So the president has been going all in for this victory.
And the concerns on the part of Democratic senators have been real, not cosmetic. There have been two senators who said they won't support it. High profile Chuck Schumer, the next Democratic leader of the Senate, Bob Menendez, the former top Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee. But Amber, we may be at the point now where the president won't even have to veto a resolution of disapproval. It might not even have enough votes to get to his desk in the first place. Nobody expected that.
Nobody expected that, you know, especially when you look at the lobbying effort against the deal. You know, very powerful pro-Israeli groups have been putting tens of millions of dollars into Democrats to try to get them to join Chuck Schumer and Bob Menendez to not support the deal. That just hasn't worked. And like you said, when Senate Democrats do come out in support of the deal, or any Democrat, they mention how tough this decision has been for them, that they've been going to, you know, dozens of briefing meetings. Senator Bob Casey wrote an 8,000-word memo yesterday in explaining his decision. And I think that's a reflection of how unpopular back home this deal has become. You know, we've seen a Quinnipiac University poll on Monday that said 25% of Americans support the deal, just 25%. So this is a really tough vote for Senate Democrats, and yet they're taking it.
And whether or not the fact that only 25% of Americans support the deal translates to somebody voting against you because you made a mistake, you know, the kind of vote like the Iraq war authorization, that's a totally different story. However, the White House winning its fight to get Senate and House support for the Iran nuclear deal. Amber Phillips, reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
What's next is a big question looming over President Obama if he does indeed get the votes he needs in September for this Iran deal, as we've been discussing. Ambassador Nicholas Burns is a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a former Undersecretary of State. He's testified several times in favor of the agreement in congressional committees. But Burns says that the Republicans do have a point. In 10 to 15 years, Burns believes that Iran could emerge more powerful and that President Obama and his successors have a lot of work ahead of them to make sure that doesn't happen.
It's been a fascinating debate on Capitol Hill. I testified before four of the committees and heard the complaints. I think the Republicans had the advantage in July because they were nearly unanimous in condemning the nuclear deal with Iran. And the Democrats laid back, and many Democrats were wavering. They were under tremendous pressure in their constituencies. But I think in the end, President Obama and Secretary Kerry have been able to make one compelling argument. What's the alternative? What's the alternative to a negotiated agreement that has been underway for 2 years that every other major country in the world supports, and that's going to freeze Iran's nuclear program for 10 or 15 years? And I think it was that argument, that walking away, which was a Republican argument, and hoping for a better deal later, it just simply wasn't practical. I think the debate turned on that issue, and now you've seen this cascade of Democrats coming forward to support President Obama.
And you've made that very argument in all of those hearings, which I watched and attended. You made that very argument to lawmakers that the deal is far from perfect, there are significant concerns, but that their alternative is far worse, or that really there is no alternative. So going forward, you've been writing about what President Obama should be doing, given a very imperfect deal, to reassure allies and strengthen the United States' position vis-a-vis a recalcitrant Iran going forward here. What are some of your recommendations?
I support President Obama, that this is the right deal for us. But the problem with the deal, and there are some downside risks here, is that after about 15 years, during which time Iran's nuclear program will have been frozen, at 15 years, most of those restrictions are taken off Iran. So theoretically, Iran could reconstitute a civil nuclear program. It could use that as a cover for a military program.
President Obama has said rhetorically many times that Iran cannot be allowed to get a nuclear weapon and that he won't allow it. Are you arguing that he needs to make a change, not just in rhetoric, but in doctrine, that the United States take a different posture about a nuclear Iran and how it will respond if Iran cheats?
I do think that is the right way forward. There have been isolated statements by President Obama in the past, including one just a couple of weeks ago, but there hasn't been a fully fledged American strategy for the Middle East. I think that's where the president needs to go now. If you liken it to what President Truman did when communism was on the march in Eastern Europe in the late 1940s, he issued the Truman Doctrine, which essentially said, we will not let Greece go communist. We will not let Turkey go communist. Well, there ought to be an Obama Doctrine, and his successors are going to have to embrace it, which would say, we will not allow Iran to go nuclear. So that would have to include a firm, unequivocal pledge by the United States that if Iran violated the nuclear agreement and drove towards a nuclear weapon, the United States would use military force to prevent that from happening. That would include, Todd, some of the other elements that I've mentioned. The United States needs to lead a coalition of countries, the Arab states, Turkey, our European and Asian allies, to re-sanction Iran should it violate the agreement, and we need to build up Israel and the Arab states. That would be a American strategy for the Middle East.
Now, one thing that could be on the upside here within what you're talking about, some senators have made the argument, as imperfect as this deal is now, is that with this international agreement, if Iran does cheat 8, 10, 15 years out, the world will be united against Iran. The American argument at that time to attack or to knock out Iran's nuclear capability with a military strike, that support will be there and the world will be unified. The United States will be right. Iran will be viewed as wrong. And our political position at that point would be stronger even than it is now.
It would be theoretically stronger. But in reality, what's going to happen in the next couple of months when this deal goes forward, all the sanctions that have been imposed against Iran will be taken off. And so you'll have these big trading relationships resume between Japan and South Korea and India to buy Iranian oil and gas. China's going to go into Iran in a big way. So I think the problem is in the out years, 10, 15 years from now, should the Iranians cheat then, and they've cheated in the past, so we have to expect this, I'm not sure it's going to be easy to put together a sanctions regime when the major global economies will be trading again with Iran. And this gets back to something that's critical at the center of this, American leadership. We're the only country that can pull together a big coalition. But in a way, the bigger battles are ahead. We've got to contain Iranian power. That's going to require active involvement by the United States politically and diplomatically.
Let me bring you back to the shorter term for 1 minute before we let you go, Ambassador Nick Burns. In the short term, one of the major concerns of both Republicans and Democrats is that when these sanctions are lifted, the ones that you're talking about, Iran will have a lot of income coming in. Some say $100 billion, maybe more realistically, $50 billion. And that some of this money will go toward its terrorist activities, its anti-American, anti-Israel, anti-Saudi activities, destabilizing the Middle East. This claim has troubled me to some degree because I wonder right now if Iran's activities are limited by finances, meaning would they love to be giving more support to Hezbollah or to Assad or to other groups around the Middle East, but they just can't because they don't have the money? If they have more money, do these things get worse?
I think some of the sanctions relief, some of the billions, will certainly go to the Iranian economy, which has been depressed for many years, and the Iranian people need to see an improvement in their standard of living. But here's the problem. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is a very influential part of the Iranian government, supported by the Supreme Leader of Iran. They're the ones who are funneling arms to Hezbollah and Hamas, that are instigating the war in Syria, that have fueled the civil war in Yemen by supporting the Houthi rebels. So I think we have to assume that some of these billions will go to fund the Revolutionary Guards, which gets back to, I think, the major proposal. The United States needs to push the Iranians back, not militarily, but by a coalition of countries to try to close off their avenues of support to some of these terrorist groups in the Middle East. And that means that the U.S. has to be at the center of this coalition to contain the Iranians until Iran changes, whenever that happens.
A victory for President Obama, it seems, coming in Congress over the Iran nuclear deal, but that is just step one of a years-long effort that Ambassador Nicholas Burns says we need to undertake to contain Iran and make sure now that they don't go nuclear. Ambassador Nicholas Burns, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Violent crime is down by a lot all across the country. In the last 20 to 25 years, violent crimes, including murders, have seen very, very low levels. That is starting in some places to change. Major cities across the country are seeing sizable jumps in violent crime compared to this time last year. Milwaukee is one city that really stands out. Violent crime in Bruce City is up 76%. Here's Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn.
We have neighborhoods characterized by intergenerational poverty, high rates of violence concentrated among a significant number of high-rate offenders who are heavily armed.
More than 30 other cities are seeing similar trends. Milwaukee's not alone. These include St. Louis, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and Chicago. Just yesterday, a police officer was killed just north of Chicago in Fox Lake, Illinois. And the police are on the front lines when violence spikes like this. So how are they handling the increase? Adam Planting is a police sergeant. He has experience in Milwaukee and San Francisco. He's author of the book 400 Things Cops Know. And he joins me now. Adam Planting, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
You're not in Milwaukee anymore, but you were for years. I said that violent crimes are up there 76%. It's a huge jump. From the cops' perspective, what's behind this?
Well, it's traditionally crime spikes in the summer. They call it the mean season for police work. People are out longer because of the weather, and they can get to arguing, and the arguing can turn to fighting or shooting. But it can sometimes be pretty hard to say what causes a crime spike. Is it just a statistical fluke? Those are the kind of things that criminologists tend to have trouble agreeing on. So usually what you want to do is kind of look at the long game and see if those numbers hold up over time.
Yeah, of course. And we're talking about a one-year spike, although the fact that it is so drastic in some cities gives, you know, some credence to the fact that we're seeing a real effect here. When police, however, on the beat see a spike in violent crime like this, even if they're not so concerned with statistics globally, how do they react?
You know, I think as a street cop, the numbers don't really affect you so much, whether the statistics indicate violent crime is up or down. You're dealing with it every day. You're constantly responding to calls where people are being shot and stabbed and beaten. I've been a cop for about 14 years in two different cities, and I don't know if there's ever been a significant period where I thought to myself, you know, boy, crime really seems to have taken a dip lately. In fact, I don't have anything to do. You know, there's always something. In our world, crime always seems to be up.
So in a city like Milwaukee, however, if there are more calls, more violent crimes, more murders per night, what do cops say among themselves? Is there a conversation about recent controversies over police brutality, Ferguson, some call it the Ferguson effect, that cops back off because they don't want to make a mistake or become the subject of a media storm? Does that have any credence?
I think you've seen some of that. There are cops who have said you've seen some of that in New York and Baltimore. I think that it's fair to say that when cops feel like no matter what they do, they're generating citizen complaints and being sued, if cops get disgruntled, they may do sort of the bare minimum, if that, which means that they aren't going out there and being proactive and stopping people for the kinds of violations that often yield, you know, the very best arrests and getting guns off the street. The chronic recidivist criminals aren't going to turn themselves in because of some crisis of conscience. You have to go out and get them. And if your cops are feeling put out, they aren't getting those criminals. And so, of course, they're free to keep their guns and use them to commit crimes. And the city is under-policed, and we also pay the price for that.
Adam Plantinga, I completely understand what you're saying. There's part of that that feels like blackmail. You said if cops get disgruntled because of the national conversation or a city like Baltimore or New York, they just hang back and crime can fill that void. That sounds, in a way, like a cop folding his arms and saying, well, then I'm just not going to do my job.
Right. And to be clear, that attitude is completely unacceptable. No matter what's happening in society, as a cop, it's your job. You swore an oath to do everything you can to reduce violent crime. But the reality is that it seems like this may be happening in certain urban areas across the country. And so you have to take a look at that.
A lot of these violent crimes, of course, involve guns. We all know that. Is there a gun conversation to be had here, do you think? Or is that going to be the same conversation we always have?
I think it's going to be the same conversation that we've had for a while. I mean, there's been sort of wrinkles in gun legislation, but, you know, as a cop, you believe that if a violent criminal wants to get a handgun, he's going to find a way to do it. And if someone has a lack of impulse control and decide that they want to start shooting at someone else, there's often very little the police can do about that. You often sort of respond to the aftermath and take your report and investigate it.
You know, you mentioned that the police are always dealing with violent crime, so a spike or a dip doesn't make a great deal of difference to them in how they do their job. Some cops here in New York City have told us recently that the number that really matters to them is the number of closed cases, solved crimes. That's the one that they look at. If they're solving a lot of cases, regardless of how many are happening, they're happy. They feel like they're protecting the community.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think there's something to that. That's sort of a concrete, tangible number that you can look at and say, well, I am having an effect. Again, I think that a lot of times the clearance rate is something that maybe the upper administration is looking at a lot harder than a street cop. As a street cop, you're just going out there and, you know, no matter what the numbers say, you're trying to do your job.
Adam Plantinga, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Adam Plantinga is a police sergeant. He's worked in Milwaukee and San Francisco. He's author of the book 400 Things Cops Know. In a riverbed in Iowa, just a couple of years ago, some geologists were digging around during a mapping survey. But they hit something weird and gigantic. What they found were fossils, but these were fossils full of claws and armor. And it turns out it was a new species. Well, new to us, anyway, that patrolled the oceans over 460 million years ago. These were scorpions, it turns out, but these aren't the 1 to 3 inch little scorpions you might be used to seeing scamper around a campsite. No, these were bigger, a lot bigger. James Lambsdell is going to tell us how much bigger. He's the lead researcher and author of the study detailing this discovery. He's also a postdoctoral associate at Yale. James Lambsdell, welcome to the show.
Hello.
I said bigger, much bigger. How much bigger?
So the largest ones we have were probably about 1.7 meters long. Almost the size of your sort of average adult man.
5'7", I guess. I just sort of did a calculation in my head, 5'6" or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That is an imposing, gigantic scorpion. Are they just like the scorpions that we're used to, only scarily huge?
These things were actually quite different because, of course, they were living in the sea rather than on the land. They had the hind legs were modified into these paddles to allow them to swim. And they don't have single sort of pincers at the front of the head. Instead, they have multiple sets of legs which have these great big spines on them that allow them to grab prey and tear it apart and then push it towards the mouth.
Now, we should say this is a gigantic predator that roamed the Earth 460 million years ago, is before the appearance of the dinosaurs. So these huge scorpion-like creatures were on the scene at a very, very early stage here.
Yeah, they predate dinosaurs by about 210 million years. And what's going on at this time is we do not have much on land at all. All of the biodiversity is in the oceans. And during the Ordovician, which is when this thing was living, we are having this revolution of these complex ecosystems starting to evolve and build up. And we're finding out that these animals, which we did not realize were around at this point in time, this is 10 million years older than the other sea scorpions that we found, were important members of these early ecosystems and very quickly became dominant predators.
What accounts for the enormous size in these ancient creatures?
It's difficult to say. I mean, I think being in the marine realm definitely helps you get larger because you don't have the full effect of gravity pulling you down. Possibly at this period of time, what's helping these things is either changes in the atmosphere or ocean chemistry, or potentially just the lack of these large vertebrate predators. So things, you know, things like us will compete for resources with these things. And that is potentially why just the lack of competition and the ability to just grow and grow and grow is just allowing these things sort of unfettered ability to grow as large as they physically can.
Unfettered is right. And we should also say you found one that was 1.7 meters. That doesn't mean it was the largest one. That's just the one that you found.
Oh, totally. These things shed exoskeletons. So the largest one would have shed that exoskeleton and then grown some more. So these things probably got bigger than that.
Potentially much bigger. You need to find another fossil to know. These fossils were found in a riverbed. You said these were marine creatures. So this upper Iowa region where your fossil was found used to be under the ocean.
Yeah, basically at this period in time, North America was part of this supercontinent called Laurentia. Iowa at the time was on the coastline, and so we had this deep ocean, and then these animals were living in an old meteorite crater that sort of provided a sheltered, less oxygen-rich environment that they could congregate into and molt without anything disturbing them.
All right, before we let you go, Dr. Lambsdale, I'm going to take a crack at this. Pentacopterus decorahensis, did I get it right?
Yep, that's perfect.
Pentacopterus, a giant, well, from our point of view anyway, giant sea scorpion, 1.7 meters, that's 5.5 feet to you and me. Ancient scorpion discovered under what is today a river in Iowa. James Lambsdale is the lead researcher and author of the study detailing this scarily giant ancient scorpion. He's a postdoctoral associate at Yale. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I kind of love that you're making me wait.
You are the best wife ever! You are the best wife ever!
Oh, I didn't get you the iPad. I got to the store and they were all out. I'm so sorry.
No. You didn't get there at 6:30. Where were you?
I set the alarm for 5. I got up. I came downstairs. I fell asleep.
No!
Well, there you have it. Intimacy perhaps destroyed by a modern device on Modern Family. Look, most of us are connected almost all of the time. And our online lives have an impact on our real-world lives. We all know this to be true. But according to new data from Pew Research, a good percentage of Americans report fighting with their partners specifically over time spent online and on that smartphone. Now, you've been telling us about it.
This is Bridget from Worcester. Sometimes I feel like my husband spends more time holding his iPhone than he does holding my hand, and it's frustrating.
Hey, this is Jerome from Florence, South Carolina, and when it comes to tech, my wife and I are polar opposites. And while she's Facebooking it and checking social media, my interest is in keeping up with work, emails, text messages. And while it's never strained us, it has definitely robbed us of some of our together time.
Okay, so one story of strain there, one story of not strain so much, but maybe a block in between people. Other studies do show that couples who tech together might stay together or at least feel more connected to each other. So it's not all bad. How important is it really to be technologically compatible with your other half. Can a Luddite really live with somebody whose idea of a soft touch is a touchscreen? Ian Kerner is a psychotherapist and an author who specializes in couples counseling, and he joins me now. Ian, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, nice to be here.
You heard some of the complaints from some of our listeners, and I doubt that any of them are unfamiliar to you.
Not at all. I mean, I see so much technology incompatibility as one of the main subjects in therapy. And, you know, listening to the folks calling in, one thing that occurs to me is so often couples are really having what I would call side-by-side conversations. They're not having direct face-to-face conversations because they're also on an iPhone or a gadget. So they're partially sort of vacated. And it's interesting, in couples therapy, sometimes that's the only time they're actually having a real, genuine face-to-face conversation.
Part of the question, of course, is how new that really is. I mean, 20 years ago, you would have had the image of one person sitting on the couch staring at the TV watching the game, the other person wanting conversational intimacy or another kind of intimacy and not getting it. Now, the devices are more mobile. We all know that. And they come with us to places maybe where they shouldn't. But the idea of distraction because of technology, that's not new.
No, although I think the demands for our attention through technology are perhaps much greater than they have been in previous years, whether it's our work lives, which are steadily expanding. People seem to need to always be on, always prepared to work in this sort of global economy. You have major companies like Facebook and Instagram. I mean, they're all making such excessive demands on our attention that I think it's probably more challenging for today's couple to focus on each other and their family life than it was in previous generations.
Now, you mentioned something interesting. It's not so much that the technology is the problem. You said tech compatibility, which means both members of the couple are on board with each other. Listen to John here.
This is John from St. Louis. My girlfriend and I are huge nerds. So when I'm not teaching her to play Minecraft on our laptops, we're curled up together with our Nintendo 3DSs and visiting each other in Animal Crossing. We both love our technology.
So for John and his partner, the technology itself is one of the bridges to intimacy for them. They love it.
Yeah, I think that's great. I see so many forms of technology and compatibility coming into my office, you know, mainly where one person will be an avid user of technology and the other person is, you know, more of an abstainer. I mean, I was just dealing with this recently with a couple. The wife is sort of sublimating a lot of energy into Instagram. I mean, always taking photos of the family, of outings, of vacations and meals. The whole family calls her paparazzi as a nickname because she's always snapping photos of everything. And they had come back, they were in session, and they had a huge fight because they were out on vacation, they were getting ice cream, and the husband just wanted to eat his ice cream, and the wife was just like, hold on, let me, I want to get the perfect shot of all three ice creams together and all of us together eating the ice cream, and he just wanted to take a bite of his ice cream, and he couldn't. And finally, you know, he just erupted, you know, and started cursing about just wanting to eat his bleeping ice cream, and, you know, she felt extremely humiliated and embarrassed that this had happened in front of her kids and in front of other people. And I'm really seeing those kinds of conflicts way more where, you know, a member of a family does not necessarily want to be documented. They don't want to be up on Facebook. They don't want their kids up on Facebook.
So there are a lot of people listening now, Ian, who are hearing threads of their own life in this conversation, I'm sure. Not exactly like what you're describing, but they go, oh, yeah, I do have part of this in my life. There's no simple checklist answer, I'm sure, but what are a couple of steps that people can take to get on the same page with their technology so maybe they don't wind up in your office complaining about it?
Yeah, it's funny. I had my own experience in my relationship with social media. My wife was on Facebook for a while, and for a brief moment, I was on Facebook, and then I went off because really as a therapist, you don't want your patients trying to friend you. It just creates added complexities. But I realized, you know, for a little while with my own wife, like I didn't really want her to be my friend on Facebook because I didn't want all of that extra information. If anything, I wanted a little less information. I wanted more mystery, more unpredictability. I didn't want to know that, you know, she was posting about being tired and having her third coffee for the day. And so I specifically unfriended her for my brief tenure on Facebook. And, you know, it's something that I do recommend to couples that, you know, there is something about being in a relationship where you want some unknowingness and you want some unpredictability. The other thing I would say to couples is, don't use therapy as your chance to have a face-to-face conversation. Put the devices down. You know, studies have shown that even if there's a device nearby, it can change the texture of a conversation. So we're looking at each other right now eye to eye. Who knows, if I had a phone out here in front of me that was, you know, buzzing or beeping or was on silence mode, I would already be distracted. So try and have those true, genuine face-to-face conversations. The other thing I would say is, you know, I'm not one for like buzz terms, but maybe you do need to go on some sort of, you know, digital diet or something. When you add up all of the periods of distraction that devices give us, you know, you might have a lot of time at the end of the day that you could put towards your relationship. We live in a culture where, first of all, sex ruts are epidemic. People go to bed too tired to make love. They have no time for each other. And yet they're spending hours a day on social media, on blogs, on Netflix and whatnot. Maybe we really need to figure out, you know, how to sort of turn off that faucet.
Maybe the advice to turn off that faucet, put the device aside, not so surprising. But Ian Kerner says, if you love someone, unfriend them. That's the takeaway from this conversation.
I will stand by that.
Ian Kerner is a psychotherapist and author who specializes in couples counseling. Thank you for helping us understand some of the difficulties with technology and relationships.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. For the first time in 25 years, our friends from Sesame Street are returning to the Persian Gulf. This Friday, the Arabic version of Sesame Street, which ended in 1990, will premiere on 9 channels across the Persian Gulf. The show also brings back its favorite local characters, Noman, the camel, and Melsoon, the parrot. That's all for today, but if you want to respond to anything you heard on today's program, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can leave your comments at thetakeaway.org. Ask me anything on Twitter, if you like. I'm at Todd Zwillick, and I'm, well, on there maybe a little bit too much, too. All journalists are. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick, filling in this week for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.